Mr. Hallsworth, reel 7. So you're at your court martial and you'd been offered a defence officer.
Yes, and I turned it down. So they went along with this, but I said I'd like to make a statement first of all. So they said, okay. So I said, well, I think the whole court martial is illegal, against the law of the land. And it was funny, just before I'd been arrested, I'd been in the reading room in the barracks, and I was reading the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, you see. I think it was Article 12 or 14 or something like that, gave you the right to organise. And I said this, and I said that the United Nations Declaration was signed by Lord Halifax, representing the British government. So, in fact, then it became statute law. It became incorporated into the laws of Britain, because he'd signed it on behalf of Britain. He'd been empowered by Parliament to sign it on behalf of Britain. So it was accepted, the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights was part of the statute law of Britain now. And so their acts were illegal because they were flying in the face of statute law. So they called a recess. You know, they, oh, well, we'll have to adjourn. So I was taken back to the cell. And then they reconvened it, and the charge had been altered to one of provocating speeches tending to cause a disturbance. In other words, the 1936 Public Order Act. So they charged me on that. But I mean, the thing was a real farce. They had these, the prosecution were bringing up these kooks, you know, saying I'd been complaining about stuff. So I said, well, you know, it's in King's Regulations and Admiralty Instructions. This is procedures set up, so you can complain. So how, carrying out the procedures, am I breaking laws, you see? They didn't want to make it political. That was the thing that came out. They were trying to avoid all the politics. They didn't want communism mentioned, you know, or anything. So they were forced then to do it as though I was just a provocateur, taking on the goodwill of the Navy, you know. It was going, so I was found guilty, you know. They were, it was a foregone conclusion. And I was found guilty and sentenced to a month's imprisonment in Exeter Jail. Now, the surprising thing was, they gave me my discharge papers. Now, when you're dishonourably discharged, they cut the top right-hand corner off, and it's marked to be cut off, you see. And that shows you're dishonourably discharged. I mean, you can't replace it if it's been cut off. Because your discharge papers is like cloth material, cloth paper, paper, you know, back with cloth. And mine was still on, so I'd been honourably discharged. You know, it was quite fun. But one of the funny things was, the guy that took me down to cells, I was put under escort and taken to Exeter Prison. They took take all your kit and auction it off. They take your hat band, your collar, and all the, you know, marks of rank. And so you're just left with a basic uniform with a hat with no headband on, no hat band on, and all your, all the rest of your stuff, I mean, I had two kits, was oxy enough. I think I got about £5 or £6 for the lot, you know, and there was all sorts of stuff. And all they got was, I was allowed one suitcase. So I wanted my books, you know. It was a big leather suitcase that I had. So they packed it full of books. It was quite funny. The Master at Arms, they were making an inventory of them. It was, I sent it to Elsie. And he was reading them out, and he was, it was like a comedian. He was saying, state and revolution. The proletarian revolution and the renegade Kautsky. He was horrified by all these things. But I was put under escort, and one of them was called Ronnie Smith. He was the leader of the escort. I don't know if you've seen the television programme Heidi High. Well, Sean, the comedian, the big fat comedian, that's Ronnie Smith. Really, of course, he was quite young and slim then. And as we were going on the train from Plymouth to Exeter, I was really working on them to try and get them to desert with me, you see. And he was saying, shut up, stop talking to me, stop talking to me. And he could really feel himself being won. It was quite funny. But I was amazed when I saw him on the programme, you know, recognised him. But he was Ronnie Smith, he's called. But I went to Exeter and I was put in a cell. Well, I mean, it was like a holiday. You got library books, 3 books a day.
Just before you go on, was this a naval prison?
No, it was a civilian prison. Yes, and it seemed like a real doddle.
And were you on your own?
Yes, I was by myself in the cell. And we were in the cell 23 and a half hours a day. We were half an hour out for exercise, that was all. That was for the first week, I think it was. And then, after that, you came out for a couple of hours and you was like sewing mailbags. We were all sewing mailbags, they didn't put us on any other way. We were the star prisoners. You know, I was only in for a month. You didn't get any reduction on a month. If you were 3 months, you could get a month off, you know, for good behaviour. But on a month, you didn't get any good behaviour off. But the first week, I stopped smoking, you know, because it was a waste of time. You could buy this Black Beauty, which was very, very strong tobacco. You only needed one strand of it rolled up in paper, and it went right to your head. You know, you were light-headed from it. Very strong it was. You got a quarter of an ounce. Got 8 pence a week wages, which enabled you to buy a quarter of an ounce and some papers. And they provided you with matches. They give you about 5 or something. So that's when you had to shave them up. But I stopped smoking. I thought, blow it, you know. And it was a doddle. The food wasn't... You really enjoyed your food because you were really hungry. In the morning, you got... a cob of bread and a pat of butter and a cup of tea. Well, what you did, you used to shave with the tea because you had these very blunt blades, you know, so you couldn't do them in cold water. So you used to use your tea for shaving with. I mean, it was filthy stuff. But and you save your sugar. You had a little metal canister of brown sugar. You saved that for your cocoa at night, see, so you'd had quite a sweet cup of cocoa. You got a proper dinner. And then at tea time, you get like bubble and squeak or something. It'd be the potatoes and cabbage, you know, peppered a bit from what had been left from dinner. But they kept me isolated. I was amazed, because when I was talking to the prisoners in the prison, they were all Tories. They were all right-wing politics. They supported royalty, you know, House of Lords. Because, I mean, they needed the rich for their lifestyle, sort of. They had to have somebody to rob, you know. But they were all Tories. I never met a left-winger in prison. There's not an area one, certainly not admitting to it.
Was the what was the standard of the building and everything like? Did you have to slop out and everything?
Oh yeah, you had to slop out. But I'd been in the Navy, you know, you were used to roughing it.
But it's no worse than it is today, you think?
I mean, you better today.
It's better in
prison
today.
Oh yeah, yes. We had a wooden board for a bed, you know, and a palliasse thing. You didn't have a mattress, a sprung mattress. This is what I say. 51, you know. We were used to austerity. Oh, we were working class. We lived in austerity conditions. You had flock beds at home, you know. You never sprung mattress. Bloody hell. They were for the middle class, sprung mattresses. You had a palliasse filled with straw, I suppose. And a couple of sheets and a blanket. That's what you had. And a pillow. But... I found it comfortable. In fact, it was a doddle. It was like a holiday. I had a rest. I shaved off my moustache. and shed about 10 years, you know. I looked about 30 till I shaved it off.
You didn't dye your moustache
then? No, no. But it was a doddle prison. And then came home into Civvy Street.
How did your family and friends reacted to being in prison? Had you heard from your parents or anything?
Yes, I had a letter from my mother saying that Elsie had gone along. I'd written to Elsie, my girlfriend then, and told her that I was been discharged from the Navy. So robbed them of 7 years, because I'd only done 7.5 years. And was going in prison for a month. So I'd see her in a month, sort of thing. So she was quite pleased about this, you know. I went quite cheerful to, we were engaged at the time. Went to see my mother, and my mother, oh, what will the relatives think, and that. And she wrote me this really nasty letter saying, I'd always been a big disappointment to my father. I'd always been a big disappointment to my father. Couldn't believe it. So I thought, shrugged it off. It was just one, another barb. I never bothered. Yeah. So I was glad to be out. I remember coming back on the train to Manchester. I was very anti-religious as well by this time. And there was a parson inadvertently got into our carriage. And so I gave him a right going over on religion. Because while I was in the Navy, I read the Bible after I read Fraser's Golden Bough. And then the Koran, you know, and whatever I could get my hands on, the other ones, you know. And so I was quite ginned up on religion. So I gave this parson a mauling. And I threw my hat away. So I was quite, you know, glad to get home. But they had reconciled themselves to it by then. I had some big rows with my father. My father still... I remember one row about, I was saying that all this Adam and Eve was just a fable, you know, and he was saying it was the truth, you know, it's the God's truth, God's word sort of thing. And we had a big row, and he flaked out, had a blackout and flaked out. Oh, he told me to clear off, leave the house. So I thought, oh, I cleared off, I don't know how I was clearing off to. I was going to catch a bus somewhere. And my mother came running after me down the back. Oh, come back, your father's collapsed. So we never, you know, got into many arguments after that. But it was funny, I came out and joined the Communist Party. Apparently...
Why was... sorry, before you go on, why was your father collapsing like this?
He was very patriotic and...
But he wasn't religious.
Hmm? Oh, there was something wrong with him, yeah. He'd had a number of things while I was in the Navy, which I'd missed. Peritonitis and all this, you know. And I'd missed that. And so he had... And he had blood pressure as well, you know. He just had a blackout.
But so, these were nothing to do with the conditions that he'd lived in or anything?
Ah, he was iron moulding then. You know, they were terrible conditions. He was at Austin Hopkinson's. And the dirty places to work in a foundry. You know, full of fumes. Dirt and sort of working in this black sand. And, I mean, he was a real mug. He'd invented this process of making castings, which saves 75% of the waste. Because when they make a casting, they've got a machine, you see, and because they're rough, the castings. Well, he did this method of mixing the sand, which cut out 75% of the wastage. And he gave it to the boss. Instead of patenting the thing, you see, the boss made thousands and thousands. He got nothing for it. It was a real mug, you know. And then his other mate opened up this place in Wales and wanted him to come and work with him as foreman, you know, when this process, because they were always thinking of ways to do it better, you know. And, he didn't want to move to Wales. So we stayed on in this rotten job with Austin Hopkinson. And Hopkinson was one of these family concerns where they used to take them for a trip out, you know, all the holidays and all that, and I've give them a meal and that. But they started organising Foundry Workers Union and wanted the conditions, showers and stuff, proper toilets and a proper canteen. So he cut all this other thing out. I mean, well, what use were it? You wanted proper conditions. He was a trade unionist, my father, but and voted Labour. His father was a skilled worker as well, a hatter, who was a Liberal, and then Lib Lab sort of thing. But he was from the skilled worker, still skilled working class, you know. His brother was a draftsman, and so on. But he'd no real idea. He was good-hearted. Everybody liked him. Everybody liked him. When he was ill, oh, there was dozens coming from the factory to see him, you know, and all that. Harry Holdsworth, they all liked him. But he'd no idea. And he was very religious as well. And him and my mother were very, very close to each other, so much so they didn't need anybody else. Everybody else was eased out, you know. They were very, very self-sufficient into themselves. It was a real blow when he died for my mother, because she'd never needed anybody else, you know. Now she was stuck with nobody. But and they were both very religious. And I wasn't close to them anyway. My brother had started work on the railways, and then he moved away to get away from them because she was very possessive, my mother, to him. And he moved to Birmingham. So I came out at this period, and she used to have her ways of really running my father. She'd get face ache, or cry a bit, and he'd come home and start doing all the housework, you know, and all that. She'd done nothing all week except read magazines and what have you. And we'd get down. but it never, she could never get across to me, so she was sort of quite worried about me, you know.
So, but you came back anyway, presumably, because it was the only place to go.
Yes, yeah, I mean, where else was it to go?
And how did they react to you coming back and to you seeing Elsie? Did they know Elsie then?
Yes, Elsie had gone to see them.
Did they blame her for
transformation? Yeah, they blamed it on her, of course.
Did that annoy you?
I took the notice of them. They couldn't get through to me at all. I had no feelings one way or the other with them, you know. I was beyond being annoyed with them.
Did they think that you were weak for following what she was saying? Or
They knew I wasn't weak. I don't know what they thought. They knew she'd sort of introduced me to it. But, I mean, I'd grasped it like a drowning man grasps a straw, you see. I mean, I was far more enthusiastic about it than she was. Although she was in the Young Communist League and she had the daily work around, you know. But I came back and started doing the party work. I joined the party.
Did you, before you talk about that, did you hear from anyone that you'd known in the Navy?
No, never.
So that was the last you sort of saw?
That was the last I saw them.
Even though you'd been quite close to people like Bell and...
Yeah, never heard of. Don't know what happened to them. Maybe they got them as well, I don't know. No, I never heard.
So anyway, you were back in Ashton then?
Yeah, while I'd been in the Navy, while they were having me on trial, Elsie had been writing to the Daily Worker, to William Rust, who was then the editor of the Worker. Never got a reply back. They wouldn't reply.
You mean writing about your case?
Yes, hoping they'd take it up. They wouldn't even reply to her. And
why would that have been, do you think?
They didn't want to get involved. Subverting the forces.
They supported the...
The real patriots they were. I mean, they'd run the last war for them, for the bosses.
Can you go into that a bit? What you mean by that?
Well,
it sounds you'd think the Communist Party would be rather anti the forces.
No, they... I mean, at the beginning of the war, Pollitt and Willie Gallagher And what was he called? The guy that was editor of the Worker. And then, I forget what he was called now. But they supported the war. And then Dimitrov from the Third International sent this thing to Palm Dutt. And they kicked. Willie Gallagher stayed on the fence. But, J.R. Campbell was the editor. And Pollitt came out supporting the war. And Dimitrov said, there's no two fronts. Like Pollitt and them were saying, it's one front. It's imperialists fighting each other. So we're against our own imperialists. So Pollitt and Gallant and J.R. Campbell were kicked out, kicked off the leadership, and Palm Dutt and them took over. It was only when Russia came into the war that Pollitt and them came back. And then they were really enthusiastic. I mean, if you read in engineering particularly, they ran engineering, English Electric works on the East Lancs Road. Was it D.N. Napier then it was called? They got older, they were really onto the Minister of Labour, you know, get this factory working and all this. And Napier were making planes, and they had all sorts of machinery. They got it working. In the other factories, they had clapped out machinery, you know, working. They were forcing up the production figures and all that, really getting onto absenteeism and people late. Oh, they had the joint productivity councils where they were. And they went to the Minister of Labour, Ernie Bevan, and because the engineering bosses were saying, you can clear off, I run this firm, you know. And they said to him, you know, you'll have to intervene. They want to run it themselves, the bosses. And they forced them to kowtow, you know, to make some sort of agreement with the productivity councils. And they really ran the thing, you know. And, I mean, they had Metrovics, they had great big photos of Stalingrad up to put the production up. In Metrovics, my brother-in-law was one of the conveners there during the war. They had, towards the end of the war, did all the foremen and inspectors joining the Communist Party because they thought the Communist Party was taking over after the war. And they were like running things, they're running the factory. So they thought they'd be running society, you know. Little did they know. But, there was no way they wanted to be seen, to be accused of, because it was the Cold War. I mean, the Cold War had started. It was at its heights. I mean, you were really ostracised as a communist. You were really sort of victimised at every turn. I mean, it was the whole state. It's like the... like the states organised against the blacks now. Immigration controls, all these, you know, things. Well, it was all geared then against the communists. And blimey, you knew all about it.
So you came out of the army.
Navy.
And were you... the Navy. And you were... how did you react to this then? Because you'd been reading all the Communist Party stuff.
I was surprised.
Suddenly you find out that they hadn't been... interested in what you were doing.
If she'd been sending me the Daily Worker, it would have been better, instead of this bloody Soviet Weekly. But I was amazed, because I was expecting things to be on the brink of revolution. You know, the workers organised and all that. You'd think, well, haven't they seen it all, you know? You'd think they'd see it. I mean, you'd found out. That was the thing. When you learn about these things, you expect... the first thing you think is, if I tell my mate, he'll support it, because he's my mate, you know. And when he doesn't, you know, you can get somebody there and they don't support it, you're really flabbergasted. But I was staggered. And when I joined the party, I mean, I was all for Soviets, state and revolution, the April thesis and so on. And here the Communist Party were talking about parliament. Well, I mean, the Bolsheviks had dealt with the issue of parliament, that it was completely useless, it was a bourgeois rule. Parliament, and the working class had to rule directly, not through some other organisation, but themselves directly. And here the Communist Party and the British Road to Socialism was on about reformist politics. So I was having big clashes at every branch. And the The branch itself had been, they'd accepted British Road to Socialism with, you know, extreme reluctance. They'd fought against it and had actually had talks with Eric Heffer, who had left the party over the British Road to Socialism.
So the British Road to Socialism was a sort of document, was it, that actually confirmed that the revolution was no longer...
It was the programme of the Communist Party. Some said that Stalin had a hand in drawing it up, which said that there was a British road to socialism, as opposed to the Bolshevik road to socialism, and that they'd be able to do it through use parliament. It'd be a unity of Labour and Communists taking over the government, and then, like the militant do now, and then an enabling act and all this. So, I mean, I said, it's rank reformism. I mean, precisely going at the opposite of everything that Leninism stood for. Because Stalinism was, you know. So we had big rows in the branch. Finally, Huey Blackwell, who was the secretary, said, if you mention Soviets again, you're expelled. So, by then, you were sort of tied up in the work, you know, so... Like a lot of others, the politics get lost in the daily struggle. Because I'd started on the railways, I'd found a job on the railways at Guy Bridge. But within a week of starting, the boss had come and said, you're sacked, see? They've received word from the Navy. So I went to see George Hales, who was the branch secretary of NUR, because I'd joined the NUR, and he was a Labour councillor. And I said, they're sacking me because I'm a communist, you see. So he went to see the boss and he said, station master, and he said, well, fair enough, but we want all the Tories off Guidebridge. We'll have just Labour. It's a Labour government, you see. You're getting rid of the communists, we'll have Tories off as well. Fair enough. We'll agree to that. But if you don't get rid of Tories, you've got to have him, or it's we'll stop the job. So they had to back down. So I got back on the job, you know. I was able to stay on the railway.
What did you think about that tactic?
Well, I mean, it was fair enough. He wasn't seriously telling him to sack all the Tories. But he was saying, all right, if you're going to sack people for the politics, we'll just have one politics. And it's a Labour government, so we'll have Labour politics and everyone else can clear off, you know. And if you don't agree to that, then, no, you won't. You can have all politics on. So he played him at his own game. So he was quite funny. I remember I organised this work to rule at Dewsnap. We were working to rule and stitching the place up. And he came along. He used to wear a bowler hat and this black suit and ride a bike. And he used to ride along the lines. He'd come along. Here he is, like a bloody big farmer. And he said to me this time, I met your type at the London School of Economics, coffee cup communists. So I said, we'll show you whether we're coffee cup communists or not. Get this sorted out or we'll, you know, we'll stop the bloody job for you. It was quite funny. I had a lot of support. I mean, it was quite funny support. We had this Harry Hemsley that was a shunter at the branch. And he'd been to Russia. He was one of the soldiers that were landed in Murmansk, and they'd mutinied, you know, refused to fire on the Russians during the wars of intervention. And they withdrew them, and when he got back to Britain, he deserted and stood away on a boat to America. And he joined the Mercantile Marine in America and then deserted and joined the army. Been in that a bit, and he deserted again. Oh, he deserted the Mercantile Marine when they were trying to ship coal to Britain during the 26th strike, you see. Well, he deserted then, joined the army. And then he left them and joined the Coast Guard. But he deserted them when he was put on this, looking after these boys, on this where he'd been in the base in the Navy, you see. So he came back to Britain and joined the RAF. And he was in the RAF during the last war. And then come out onto the railways, you see.